And we are back with episode 367 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I do not have a shoe on my head.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm glad these two slackers finally decided to join us this week, John.
And this is Brunstone from Australia, and just like, you know, of course this would happen. The one week where I get a life, and I stock up in Black Market.
Oh, we have so much to go over here. We're going to try and keep this to a normal time frame, at least, for one of our episodes. And so if it turns out that we have to cut things off a little bit and pick them up next time, then so be it. But in the meantime, we are going to go ahead and get started right away with a disclaimer. So, Edmund, if you could please.
On this show, our policy is that we will talk about anything that happened in the episode. Therefore, you will be horribly spoiled. But we always try and wait a week or so. So we certainly hope you've had time to catch up on these many, many, many shows that we are now having to watch.
That's right. And we're going to get started with, I guess, The Walking Dead. And let's run the promo.
If you want to live, you have to become strong.
There's walkers in D!
Someone attacked the cell block.
Everything we've been working so hard to keep out just found its way in.
What the hell do we do?
You're losing the war.
Carol! Hey!
The Walking Dead, season premiere, Sunday, October 13th at 9, only on AMC.
All right, and Bronstone, if you could read the description and then start us off.
Okay, well, if I'm not mistaken, we're on The Walking Dead, Season 4, Episode 1, 30 Days Without an Accident. The Season 4 opener finds Rick and the group aiming to maintain a close-to-ideal life at the prison. It seems like every season premiere for The Walking Dead is almost a pilot in and of itself. And this one's no exception. It feels like it's geared not so much towards... telling the story as it is, sort of like bringing you up to speed on where the characters are, what's changed, what hasn't changed, and in that respect, I quite liked what we got. I liked getting to explore the prison all over again and meet new people, even though some of them were clearly going to die by episode's end. It did a good job of showing my comparison was that it sort of like it felt like we had been thrust into those sort of middle of the show seasons of Lost. Sorry, Gary. Where the survivors have just, like, you know, they've got their camp set up, they've become mostly comfortable with their situation, with how they're living, and even though they've still got stuff to deal with inside their group and outside their group, they feel settled. And what danger comes from a threat to that settlement. So I liked exploring that aspect. And then on top of that, we had some good subplots. I liked the Daryl and Glenn leading the supply run. You had even though there was there were predictable moments, it was such a well-staged, well-put-together zombie action sequence that I was just really engaged the whole way through. I mean, we've seen zombies sort of, like, you know, shuffling through the doors and whatnot, but just, like, they're falling from the ceiling. That was creepy. And
you can do better than that.
Yeah.
No, they're, I think that this is best expressed with song. It's raining dead. Hallelujah.
I was trying not to. I was avoiding it.
There's no avoiding it. It's not just relevant, but it's an episode title. I didn't want you to go on a complete monologue. I think I want to go back to your first point, and that was that, you know, this is almost like resetting things to a certain point in terms of what the show is, and almost being another pilot, so to speak. And I like what you said about how this is what happens when you've kind of had stability for a while and people have settled in. And
well, I like the point about Rick, where he wasn't even tending the fence, if that's what you want to call it, that they had pretty much given him a pass from anything zombie in relation, so that he, I guess he could you know, sort of get his sanity and really come back to terms with being alive again. I thought that was it was an undercurrent till sort of the end, I guess, where you see him actually breaking up the coop. But I thought that was sort of nice, and everybody sort of acknowledged that he earned it or deserved it, even if he didn't quite feel he did. So I that sense of community that little act imparted was really nice, I thought.
Yeah, both Rick and Carl had moments like that where it's clear that they've really relished this opportunity to settle into something normal, to sort of be a family living in a place doing a job rather than being survivors of the zombie apocalypse, even while there's always this undercurrent with both those characters of they're more aware than most of how dangerous things can be. But I think, then there's a bit of a difference of you've got Carl, who I think is sort of like keen to do more, and Rick, who is would so rather just be somewhere, be doing anything else than dealing with the dead.
Mm. Edmund, how about you? Thoughts?
Yeah, this whole point of the pilot. I mean, I think, you know, certainly it has to be mentioned that, you know, this is one consequence of changing your showrunners all the time, where it's, you know, now it's got Gimble in charge, and, you know, he's got to come in and put his stamp on the show. You know, since it's, you know, now what, you know, four seasons and three different showrunners. So, but certainly, you know, given the way the way they ended things, you know, it did also kind of make sense to just jump forward and, you know, not necessarily, you know, get into the minutia of, you know, okay, how's the Woodbury folks settling in, and, you know, just sort of drop us in after, you know, they've already worked a lot of that stuff out, and, you know, just dropping little clues and, you know, yeah, you know, Rick being, you know, taking his little, you know, courtyard sabbatical, you know, and, you know, and these mentions of the, you know, of the council. So, you know, they've got some sort of organization going. But I like the way they, you know, they were just sort of tossing those in as things people mentioned, because it's just part of what's going on. And, you know, so it felt like a good mix of sort of the everyday, how to survive in this situation, stuff, combined with, you know, yeah, I mean, that, you know, just amazing over the top zombie action. So, you know, sort of trying to please both of the camps and, you know,
over the top. That was nice. Yeah, sorry, I couldn't help it. Over the top. That was good.
Just drop that one in there.
Yep. Yeah.
Well,
Seemed like a good reset and a good start to this season.
Well, the thing that struck me a little bit, and, you know, the Rick stuff and Carl stuff, that made a lot of sense to me. The whole part, and I guess they're introducing this new, honestly, because I didn't quite see it coming, but the whole thing with Michonne holding the baby, I mean, it's obviously they're laying the seeds for some story, I would assume, but I didn't expect to see her breaking down like that. Oh, am I? Oh, gosh, did I jump ahead? I do apologize.
Yes, you did.
Time travel is confusing. I'm sorry.
No, don't tell them about the time travel episode.
No, that's episode 5. Will you stop?
Oh, jeez.
The 50th anniversary Doctor Who tie-in. But the TARDIS is going to appear in the middle of the first episode.
That's right.
Right. I'm sorry, I jumped ahead.
No,
Rick,
no problem.
Rick.
But, I mean, one thing I wanted to mention, I mean, given the fact that it is the title of the episode, is, I mean, you know, yes, we have the sort of the, you know, the new characters getting integrated in, and even among the existing characters, I mean, that sort of transformation in Beth was rather striking. Talk about growing up a lot, sort of between seasons, and you know, her just, you know, sort of matter-of-factly taking the news that this guy, who, you know, certainly seemed to be her boyfriend momentarily there, you know, was gone. You know, she's hardened up, and you know, and just that very casual taking the numbers off of the days without an accident. That, you know, oh well, we're back to zero. Time to start again. So, but you know, that was a. You know, it's, you know, sort of a, you know, I like that in terms of, you know, really showing some evolution in the characters, and you know, that, yeah, in these circumstances, people are going to have to learn to just be cold about it and move on.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's the character's name? It's Beth. But as far as what I found interesting was that, you know, we're talking about people are kind of, they've become this community and what that means. And I guess for me, it's, you know, we're talking about a lot of these people were the people from Woodbury. And so they were already in a position where they were almost being sheltered from what was going on outside. And now we see that really that has continued to be the case here at the prison. They've gone from one sheltered situation to another. And the people that seem to be in charge of everything, other than a couple of people on, you know, watching the fences and stuff, it's all the people from Rick's group. There's not a whole lot of people from Woodbury that are actually doing any of the actual zombie fighting. And the ones that are not really suited to it. So, well, granted, that is partially for the purposes of the show and the ease of, you know, how you're going to write it with so many characters already. It also speaks to the fact that they've got this huge population of people that they've inherited that, while they're good for the domestic type stuff, they're not necessarily very good for the survival stuff.
And especially after we have this sense that, you know, a time has passed. So it's not like they're, you know, this is week two that they're there and, you know, we're still, we have to sort of train them and show them how to do things. I get the sense that this has been months.
Yeah.
Yes. So I don't think it was that clear in the episode, but the producers did say that I think it had been about 5 months or so was the time jump.
Well, yeah, it had been long enough for 30 days without anybody dying.
Well, yeah.
You know, progress. So they had early issues, but this was fairly good. I guess the point then that's clearly going to be driven home is, first of all, what happens when you've got that many people in a tight space and something very natural happens, like, you know, illness, but, oh, let's make it something really nasty like hemorrhagic flu.
Yes, of course.
I mean, that kid went from being fairly okay to bleeding from every orifice visible within, 12 hours? That's...
And it also, like, knowing of the, you know, the various swine flus and bird flus, you know, them throwing in the thing about, you know, the pig being a little sick earlier as well, so it's like, you know, just giving you a little heads up that, you know, yeah, this could be one of those really nasty ones they keep talking about, you know, and then, as we well know, there is no CDC anymore, so...
Well, it's not, you know, it's not like the sniffles is going to make a riveting plot, you know? Oh my God, there's no more tissues. It just doesn't cut it, so, yeah.
Hey, look, you have no more puffs with lotion. That's some nasty nose burn right there. But, they did a nice job of just hinting at everything, right? They had the pigs in the prison area. They had the boar out in the woods.
Mm-hmm. They had the venison.
The walker that had blood all over its face. So that was hinting at stuff. So yeah, it was definitely hinting that there was something going on, and people just didn't have the background to recognize it. They knew something weird was going on, but something that was going to be that virulent never occurred to them, and I don't know that it would. I mean, they have so many other things on their mind, but all I could think of was, oh boy, they've spent all this time making this a safe place, and the episode ends with they're basically locked in with a walker and they don't even know it. So yeah, that's not going to end well. Now, was I the only one who thought when Rick ran into the woman in the woods that the walkers had evolved?
No.
Initially, I mean, given her, you know, sort of extreme condition of grunge, it was, you know, I was thinking possibly, but then I figured that, you know, there's no way they've kept the power of speech, so... I was very, very, you know.
It didn't last long, but when she was there with all that stuff, all, you know, like you said, extreme grunge, and then she said something, I'm sure they did it intentionally, but, you know, my wife and I were watching, and both of us just was like, what, wait, what? But, yeah, that was...
No, I didn't see that. I just thought it was, oh, he's learned some sort of Zen trick that if he stands still, they'll just go right by him or something. Like, that was what I was thinking. I was like, wow, he's really at peace. He's just going to stand there. He's going to walk just right by because his mind is clear and his thoughts are good.
Yeah, well, although I will.
He knows to stay quiet when the clickers are around. But anyhow.
Yeah, there you go. Although the other thing that flashed through my head was, you know, was for a moment there, thinking like, you know, oh, please don't let her be another hallucination. Thankfully, she wasn't. Yeah, it's just a very strange character who, you know, I'm still not exactly certain of what the role of that little interlude was, other than, you know,
kind of thing of just this little snapshot into the way someone else has been really warped by the zombie apocalypse. And it was, I think a lot of what I got out of it at least was sort of Rick coming across someone who lost people and became a very dark, very different person because of it, and him just having this moment of remembering that, you know, he's been rehabilitating, he's been living a normal life, but he's not that different to someone like this.
Oh, you see, now I thought it was almost the opposite, where it's sort of a remark that even though they've, in a sense, both lost people that they cared about, that, you know, Rick's is banded together with other people, and that he hasn't sort of given up on everything and gone off by himself, and, you know, he's better for it. And I think that sort of, it was pointing that out to him, was how I interpreted it.
Yeah, no, I'm good with that concept, actually. But yeah, it was the cautionary tale of, what can happen if you're, you know, if you get yourself too cut off. So, you know, which is, you know, even though yes, he's there, you know, that's kind of what he's been doing. I mean, sort of, taking his time out, farming the courtyard, and sort of part of him getting back into the swing of things, or being shown the reasons to get back into the swing of things.
So now, any other thoughts, and Edmund, and what would you give this one, do you think?
I would give this an 8 out of 10. A good, solid return, but not wowing me yet, but still good, solid stuff.
Hmm. Gary?
Yeah, I'll go the 8 too. I thought it was a really strong open. The whole virus / pig carriers was a little entertaining concept, I would have liked to seen a little bit more of Farmer Rick before we got rid of him.
Mm. Did you say 8?
Yes.
Okay. And Bronze Thumb, I think that's what you gave this as well, right?
I gave it an 8. Yeah, I thought it was a strong return. It got me interested in what's happening this season. It got me invested in characters. It did everything a good first episode should do.
I would agree. That's pretty much what I was going to give it as well. So, there we go. 8s all around. And, Gary, I think that's about all that we have on the list that you actually watch, right?
I'm not a slacker, John. I do watch a lot, just not these shows. At least not yet, although I still hear Person of Interest calling me, but I've resisted so far. I don't know how much longer, but... But it's probably going to come to an end soon. Maybe probably by the holidays, I'll dive in deep and go through them.
Yeah, you are missing something there. But you know, there's another show I'm surprised you haven't seen. And just to kind of echo it, even if we don't get to it tonight, Gary, you have failed this podcast.
What?
That's from Arrow.
You'll
understand. You'll understand. If you watch the show.
We hope.
That's right.
I've watched about, I think I watched the first 4 or 5 episodes, and I think it was just too comic divergent for me.
Oh, really?
It's really the sense that I get. Now, you know, well, at the same time, if we want to just dredge back into the ancient memories that were Smallville, yeah, I realize that was derivative too, but in a lot of ways it held truer, I think, it was holding truer than Arrow does to what I consider to be, yeah, I'll pull out the term canon, and I'm just having a hard time accepting that character as, you know, as Queen. I guess I need to step back a little bit and need to look at it as just, you know, solely itself, and maybe that would you know, mitigate things a little bit. But I guess I was expecting a little bit closer to a more recognizable adaptation of the comics, and it really is not it. They pepper in names and a few concepts here and there, but it really is more of a unique creation and doesn't owe much to the comic books.
Yeah, the irony being that there's almost a certainty that they are going to link Arrow and the impending potential spin-offs from it with the Man of Steel and subsequent stuff. So that'll become part of the DC analog to what Marvel's doing with movies and TV. So just something to keep in mind. But we'll let you
know.
You gotta move on.
I will keep. I do have resources to get it. Maybe I'll try and catch up on at least the first season. But that was my difficulties with it. But I have heard good things about it. You know, I guess I'm just too crotchety in my middle to old age.
All right. Well,
yeah. The only thing I just want to jump in and say is that also they are evolving the character from that starting point. So.
Oh, definitely.
Have they? Okay.
So, you know, especially at this beginning of this second season, it's, you know, you can kind of think of it as though they're doing an extended origin story in a lot of ways. So.
He hasn't become mayor yet, has he?
No.
Okay.
No.
There's hope. All right, sir.
All right,
hey, guys.
See you next time. All right. Okay, guys, we've got to jump into a couple other things here. We're not going to get to everything that we have yet to cover since a few weeks ago, but we're going to bang a couple of these out. Let's go ahead and start with Supernatural. We have a couple episodes here we wanted to talk about, and the first one is the ninth season premiere. Let's go ahead and run the promo.
What's going on? Are you okay?
Look, there's no easy way to say this. Something happened back there in the church. You died, Sam. You understand that we're inside your head.
You're trying to tell me that my brother's life is in God's hands?
Just because you're dying doesn't mean you're dead. We're gonna fight this.
You're gonna give us the name of every demon on Earth.
That line doesn't sound like me.
Never get tired of doing that.
I thought the world was ending.
Close.
I will devote my life to helping you all.
They don't want your help. They want your head.
What you call dying, I call leaving a legacy.
There ain't no me if there ain't no you.
There's nothing to fight for.
You go to hell and you tell him I'm coming.
Hello, Sam. I've been waiting for you.
All right, and let's see. That would be Supernatural season... where is that? Season 9, episode 1. I think I'm going to like it here. Sam collapses as season 9 begins, and Dean sends out an emergency plea via prayer to every angel in the area to help Sam. In exchange, Dean agrees to owe that angel a favor, but his request is answered by numerous angry angels who want to kill him, as tends to happen. Meanwhile, Castiel struggles to survive without his powers. All right. Wow, yeah, Jeremy Carver starts his second season as showrunner with a bang, to say the least. Quite a lot needs to be covered here, but Bronstein, why don't you get us started? Just basic thoughts, maybe highlight or something.
Basic thoughts was I thought it was a strong return. I thought I didn't necessarily know how they were going to deal with angels. Like, part of me kind of half suspected that all of the angels were going to be like Cass and had lost their grace. But I kind of like the fact that they're not doing that, that the angels have sort of become another pest flying around, albeit an extremely powerful one, and that Cass is even more on the back foot than I think we've ever seen him. I like that we're still getting that same thing that these characters have always done, that desperation when it comes to trying to save one another. Even though at the same time there is this recognition on both their parts that, you know, in the past this has sort of led them down a bad path. There's different conflicts going on, like, at the same time. There's the obvious ones between hunters and angels. There's the whatever's going to brew up between Sam and Dean when Sam finds out what's going on. There is you know, Ezekiel's presence. I'm very curious about where that's going to go. I came away from this episode very, 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 very interested in where this is going. I want to see more. I want to know how these stories play out.
Evan, how about you? What was your reaction to this?
Yeah. I mean, I was certainly kind of stunned at at the sort of level of action, but kind of happily so, reaping a Winchester. Then yes, I come and do this personally. It's kind of a nice nod to the history. There was definitely that sense, even just in the time I've been watching it, guys, you're going here again. Now Sam running around, with Hilo in his head, I feel like they managed, they've managed to pull it off, but it's sort of like, they keep going to the similar well, and we'll have to see in terms of how they play this out of Sam, once again being kind of split and literally of two minds. But certainly, it was one of those episodes where everything was so fast and slam bang that it was more sort of after the fact that when you start thinking about what happened and trying to piece it together, that becomes clear. But certainly, as far as the reaction while watching it was, that there are, they're really going all out.
Definitely, and nicely showing us all the different versions of angels out there, and this whole idea that they're going after Castiel for really kind of precipitating their fall. I like what you were saying, Bronstone. Yep. They're less and less like Castiel, and it's almost like there's an entire cadre of Lucifers, only perhaps not in the same power.
Well, we only ever saw. We never saw them en masse before. We only saw particular ones on missions, on that kind of thing. We've seen the regime changes and stuff like now and stuff like that. But what's different now is that it's just all of them are in the mix. It's just they can open up a whole new spectrum of angel personalities.
Yeah, and what do you guys think about the whole idea of Ezekiel being basically inside of Sam and Dean agreeing to that and kind of keeping it to himself between him and Ezekiel, not telling Sam about it?
Well, that's very, very consistent with Dean, especially that he would do anything to save his brother. And in this case, the format's taken is this kind of, it's not just keeping secrets from Sam, it's this blind trust in Ezekiel when every other angel who's rocked up since the fall has been antagonistic. I can see him making the decision in the heat of the moment, being that desperate. What I want to see as the season goes on is him starting to question Ezekiel, starting to question how much of what he's seeing is Sam and how much is something trying to be Sam for some other purpose.
Yeah, and I'm personally interested. I mean, we know that Sam has had a bit of a history, not the least of which is recently having had Lucifer in his head, and now Dean had to basically, just to keep Sam alive, had to agree to have another angel in there now that he doesn't really know anything about. Let's say it was Castiel for whatever reason. I think he'd be conflicted, but he'd feel pretty good about the whole thing. I at least know Castiel and he knows us, and we have this guy Ezekiel. He has no real idea other than the fact that Ezekiel basically said, I need Sam to heal, I need to be able, Sam needs me to enable for him to heal, and I need him to enable myself to heal. So yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, this sounds like it's for mutual benefit, but who knows? I mean, that's maybe what I took away from the whole thing as far as what the other angels were demonstrating, was that they could be pretty sneaky if they want to be. You know, we've got the one who was dealing with Castiel that was appealing to his pride and everything else, while at the same time preparing to take him out at the first opportunity that it seemed like he wasn't going to play along, or even if he did. So, yeah, to me, I have a lot of questions about Ezekiel. How about you, Edmund? Your thoughts on that?
I thought it was actually a canny bit of casting that, you know, having Thomas Pennicott come in, you know, who with all of, you know, his sort of good guy associations, you know, which I did do think kind of helped sell the idea that, you know, okay, you know, this angel is, you know, is does certainly seem to be different. But certainly, given what seems to be happening with everyone else, it's certainly an open question over, you know, whether he's just being a little, you know, more subtle and manipulative than the other angels who just want to straight out attack are being. So, you know, yeah, that part of it, you know, I think that does set up nicely for down the road in this season.
What would you give this episode?
I would again go with an 8. You know, so it was another solid premiere that was setting up interesting things for down the road.
And you, Bronson?
Yeah, I'd do the same. It was good stuff. It got me invested in watching the rest of the season.
And that makes it a trifecta then. Very good. All right, and we're going to go ahead and move on to then the second episode we're going to cover. And here's the promo for that one.
So Crowley is alive.
He's junk in my trunk.
What the hell happened to hell?
Ezekiel?
I'm in Sam's head. Hello. Never get tired of doing that.
This is going to be fun.
Supernatural, all new next Tuesday, 9, 8 central on the CW.
Okay, and that would be Season 9, Episode 2, Devil May Care. Dean kidnaps Crowley in order to find the demons on Earth. Meanwhile, Abaddon reappears and plans to take over Hell. All right, yeah. Well, I mean, that pretty much covers it. We had a lot of good Mark Sheppard action. And, yep. Of course, it leaves out the fact that, you know, Kevin and all of his activities in this episode. And I gotta say, this was probably the first time since Kevin was introduced that I felt like they really wrote him as part of the team that is emerging here. What do you guys think?
Yeah, definitely. It was a nice job of sort of, you know, all the sort of ticks and neuroses that were, you know, that were sort of used to was in there, but didn't feel like it was, you know, he was just being thrust in there just for plot purposes. I have to make sure, yeah, this is, you know, by the end with Dean giving him the little speech about your family now, we really did ring true after what we saw.
Yeah, there's this, this weird aspect of the relationship between the Winchesters and their friends and their allies is that, and you pick up on it here and there, and the fact, the way that Dean talked in this episode, I think crystallized some of it, is that they wouldn't be asking so much of Kevin if they didn't think so highly of him. Because that's the pattern. I mean, they never... You look at previous episodes of new characters that get brought into the ensemble. I mean, look at... Oh, Garth is a perfect example. They don't start going to Garth for help or asking him to do stuff for them until they're solid on him. And I like the idea of just this, that's their really, really twisted way of expressing that familial bond. And that for once Dean had to kind of, you know, he really had to come out to someone, you know, and say the fact that, you know, you're part of the crew. You're one of us, and we're going to be here for you every bit as much as you've been here for us. And I really like that. I'm really looking forward to Kevin doing more over the course of this season. Being more of a part of the team. I can definitely see him going a more man of letters route. Mm-hmm. The way that they were taking Sam last season, that they'll take Kevin the same way. Like, he's very, you know, he's all set up to be the mission control. He's very, very smart. Not as capable in the physical arena, but he's got his chops. And I did like the exchange he had to try and get Sam and Dean into that crime scene of just trying to do the Bobby thing, failing miserably, and then just doing his own thing that worked just as well.
Yeah, I think that you make a good point there, because we're so used to thinking of the Winchesters as the quintessential hunters that this whole concept that they introduced last season of the Men of Letters has just expanded the kind of allies that they can have in the roles that they can play. And, you know, the fact that they're legacies, they're rebuilding the Men of Letters in their own fashion with the people that they can call upon, and Kevin is obviously very, very much in the running for that. But, you know, we've seen some other characters that would actually fit pretty well into the Men of Letters side of things. But all that said, there was one thing that kind of left me a little cold in this episode, and it kind of took something away from it, largely because I'm a little worried that they're going to go to this well a little too often, and that's the whole idea that, you know, they're up against this, you know, they're up against Abaddon and her people, and it's all going very badly, and then Ezekiel comes out and throws around some angel power, and that's how it kind of resolves the conflict. And I'm just a bit worried that that's going to become a very convenient plot device, because the way that they pulled it off, it wasn't the most elegant way for them to do it in the episode, and so that is what it brought to mind, was, you know, oh boy, here we go, this, you know, Castiel has lost his abilities, as we saw in the premiere, so their way of getting around that is going to have, you know, angel power on demand.
inner angel, yeah.
Yeah.
Bring out your inner angel. Yeah, although, I mean, the other thing I kind of thought about that was, you know, in a way, because it was so awkward, and, you know, that you know, it seems to me that they're setting it up for, you know, these situations to keep popping up where Ezekiel's come out, Sam comes back, and then, you know, Dean has to explain, you know, what just happened while you were supposedly knocked out. And, you know, I think the story is going to start fraying pretty quickly if, you know, that episode was any indication. So we're going to get there sooner rather than later of Sam starting to figure out something's wacky and, you know, getting the story out of Dean.
Yeah, I'm hoping that that's what it's meant for, and not to be just a replacement for Castiel's timely interventions. Yeah. Because, I mean, it's one thing if it's Castiel, right? Because that has been his power set. That's what he does, and it's not quite so convenient as having the angel hiding inside of Sam, popping out whenever they need him. That just spells disaster for me. But Bronson, how about you? Did that bother you at all, or come to mind, or did it just seem?
Honestly, it was this case of it was surprised when it happened, and I think that's part of why I sort of let it slide in this episode, was that I wasn't expecting Ezekiel to do much at this point, you know, interacting with the rest of the world beyond, say, like Dean. Or even maybe Sam at some point. So when he's just suddenly busted out angel powers, I was like, whoa, okay, that's the thing. But yeah, this could very easily become a crutch. And I really don't want them to go that route. It would take away a lot of the impact of making Cass mortal if they just had another angel there to throw out angel powers. I want to see the brothers, the Winchesters, all the good guys basically have to defeat a bigger threat without the aid of being their best tools today. See how they evolve their methods and their approaches, and how they can think, you know, think their way to overcome new problems.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So hopefully it'll go more the way that Edmund was talking about, in terms of being a reason why this whole situation falls apart sooner rather than later. But all that said, Edmund, what would you give this episode, do you think?
I think I would say a 7, a good, you know, solid average episode, but nothing much to, you know, not not great. And actually, I think there was one thing which I did see a review, which we haven't mentioned. I think does bear mentioning, was, you know, there was also that issue of, yes, these hunters who they supposedly know, who we don't, those past characters popping up who, you know, we haven't actually, you know, we don't actually know, but they're supposed, supposed to be old friends, rather than just, it's kind of like with the Angels, and, the first, just sending, he's sending the call out, going through Bobby's black book or whatever, and, which would have been perfectly fine. Of, these are just hunters who they haven't necessarily had that much interaction with, who are there to be, red shirts, basically.
I did kind of short circuit that, but I do mention that in my review, and it's one of those pet peeves that I have whenever they introduce someone who, oh, the characters have known forever, but have never been introduced to the audience before. And yes, we know there are all these other hunters out there, but it literally would take one or two lines of dialogue to cover over that, and they just didn't bother.
Yeah,
that annoyed me. It's usually my two favorite writers for Supernatural that pull that kind of crap, but it wasn't them this time, so I was a little surprised by that. But you said a 7. I agree with that. How about you, Bronstein? What would you give it?
I think I'd agree with the 7. It was a solid episode, but the what we got here didn't necessarily grab me as much as what we got in the first episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, we will obviously be circling back onto Supernatural in due time, but let's see. We're going to switch gears for the rest of this episode, I would imagine, and talk about, let's just pick one here, Homeland. That's a good one.
Okay.
And why don't we run the first promo?
I'm not the one who got it wrong. I'm the only one who got it right.
She's out for blood, Saul.
Nicholas Brody is not responsible for the explosion at Langley.
I'm going to stop her.
You need to rein her in. She's making herself a target.
She's trying to crush me.
On the receiving end, we've already identified half a dozen known associates of Abu Nazir.
What about the source?
We want the real wire transfers with the real names.
Where did you get this?
Your client is funding attacks by terrorists on this country, and all you want to know is how did we find out?
What's going on here is not okay with me.
But we're on to something, and if it leads to where I think, it will all have been worth it.
Okay, and let's see. That would be Homeland, Season 3, Episode 2. Saul attempts to track down those responsible for the Langley attack and recruits an unlikely expert to follow the money trail. Meanwhile, Quinn takes matters into his own hands, Carrie learns who is really on her side, and the Brody family turns to therapy to mend their broken household. Oh boy. Alright, I think I can encapsulate all of my comments on this one by saying this felt like the premiere, just written a little bit differently and put out again as the second episode. It practically did nothing new. And in fact, on the stuff with the Dana plotline, actually retread it so much that I felt like we were going slowly insane. But this, to me at least, when I was looking at this and I was looking at what they were doing with Carrie, it left me with the feeling that they had definitely stepped over a certain line with her. That they weren't just suggesting that she was losing her focus and losing her battle with her illness and that this was going to affect her ability to perform ever again, but taking her through such a grueling therapy and journey with this problem that anyone in their right mind would never let her anywhere near counterterrorism and analysis, given everything that she goes through and just her anguished mental state here.
Although this is the show, they did have her undergo ECT or electroshock, as it used to be known, at the end of the first season, and she was back. So I agree in terms of a realism index. It's like there isn't any way somebody in this position should just move on to be a different show because he's not getting back into the CIA. But we already know that the show is willing to. Go tread that the different path. So
Well, I mean, after her electroshock therapy, they did spend a good amount of time early in the second season.
Yeah.
Kind of negotiating a way for her to come back, and then circumstances kind of forced them to do something about it. But to me, now this being a return bout of her bipolar issues, and seemingly so much more severe in terms of the consequences, and now she's been publicly outed, even if Saul didn't say her name directly, it's almost impossible, given everything else that's been done in public testimony mm-hmm. by the senator. You know, her name has come up. It's fairly clear who they're talking about. That, you know, kind of married with this, I feel like this is going to be a line that they can't really cross back over very easily.
Yeah.
Season 24 type of, you know, shock value. No pun intended. But
yeah. What's kind of been getting to me is that, you know, yeah. So we had the hearing where no, she's not named, but then the sort of, you know, the lead up to the, you know, to the committal of, you know, her, you know, going to the reporter, so that's getting, you know, that's getting her name out there in a certain way, and then the whole, you know, from the end of the first episode, the whole, you know, confronting Saul in this public Washington restaurant, which is obviously, you know, one of those, you know, power breakfast type places where, you know, she's making a scene where there's lots of influential people who would have seen it. So, you know, it was, you know, that's what kind of got to me more, was that, you know, the whole thing of, you know, yes, he just outed you, and now you just put a, you know, you just put a face on it. So, but,
yeah, Bronstam,
how about you?
Your thoughts on this one?
Honestly, I think you summed it up at the very first thing you said, was that this just felt, you know, this felt like the premiere again. I had all the same issues. There were all the same things that I liked, but you know, not as fresh. It's just, you know, again, and then all the things that I didn't like are still there, and I like them even less. The one sort of thing that, you know, like you were saying, that what feels different is that they're taking Carrie into a point of no return. But rather than feel like, oh, this is an interesting new avenue for storytelling and drama and whatnot, instead I'm sort of sitting here just cringing and waiting for them to try and undo it, to pull a burn notice almost.
Taken in and of itself, I felt like they, not worrying too much about where they were going to have to go with this to come back from it, the episode itself I thought was pretty good. I you know, coming out of it, I can't ignore the fact that there is going to be this problem of now what. But as a meditation on Carrie's downward spiral and the wounds that she inflicts on herself, basically, you know, Edmund, you kind of put it pretty well when you said that she comes right out and basically has outed herself anyway. And so it's all so self-damning what she's doing. And, you know, meanwhile, we've got so much of what we see here is just people having to deal with the aftermath of everything that has happened before and how they're doing it so badly. You know, even Saul comes across as a real jerk in this episode.
That whole headscarf thing was
out of character for him, and it just so out of their element and so far beyond where they've been before. And so, I just taken in and of itself, I thought the episode was good. It's just in the context of the series, I feel like, how do they come back from this? Because now we've got two episodes that have just really just one doubles down on the other in terms of how far they've taken her, and we're about to talk about another episode that takes it even beyond that. But it's kind of a prelude to me saying I gave this an 8 out of 10, even though I have all of these misgivings about where they're going with this. But that's because I felt like the episode was very engaging to watch. It just doesn't necessarily come together as the next part of an ongoing story. It's hard for me to see how they can get back to being what Homeland was in, say, the first season and even the beginning of the second season. It feels like they've now just wiped out that possibility of doing that in any credible fashion. But Edmund, what would you give it, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would be between the 7 and the 8, and what you just said in terms of, you know how I felt during the episode, I mean, I think I would still give it the 8. Even the thing with the headscarf, I mean, I know in terms of, you know, just, you know, stuff I've read about the CIA, where they've had this issue, for years of, being suspicious of people, who aren't your average white guy, and sort of, being forced to turn to somebody who's different because of, 200 plus people being blown up. Even though it felt strange for the character, I mean, it wasn't necessarily a bad beat. And also, we haven't mentioned it, but I did love Quinn's little intimidation of the banker at the restaurant. So, so overall, yeah, there was enough stuff to where I can justify giving it the 8, but with reservations about all the retreading.
Bronson, how about you?
I couldn't be as positive. I drop it down to a 7. Okay. I was frustrated with the episode.
Fair enough. I mean, like I said, I was kind of being perhaps a little bit forgiving. But I don't know that I can be as forgiving if down the line they don't address this well, what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
And that said, let me go ahead and let's run the promo for the next episode, because this one's polarizing to a certain degree, but we'll get to it. Here's the promo.
Why am I here? That's a dangerous question.
Those voices in your head are not your friends. You have to make them go away. Why are you here?
Okay, and that would be Homeland, Season 3, Episode 3, Tower of David. Brody returns to his faith for guidance in an unexpected way when he finds himself facing increasingly desperate straits. Back in the U.S., Carrie struggles to connect with Saul when a mysterious man offers to help her, but at a significant cost. Bronson, why don't you just... What did you think of this one?
Well, I think it's still on my to-watch list.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
You may.
In my defense, it's been a busy week.
Well, that's all right. And this is probably the last episode that we're going to cover for this show, so you definitely don't want to be spoiled on this if you haven't already.
Alrighty.
It's kind of an experience, so we'll catch up with you next episode.
Yeah. No worries.
Absolutely.
All right. But, okay, Edmund, what would you have to say about it?
Well, this was, been kind of dreading the fact that Brody was going to, I knew from seeing the season previews that Brody was going to be back in a rather significant way. So I'd been, kind of dreading seeing what they did, but this wound up being, just sort of a completely out of left field, turnaround. I mean, certainly after those first two episodes, Washington centric and Carrie centric, and retelling the same story, to just do this complete 180 and have Brody just show up in Venezuela in this half finished skyscraper with no real explanation of how did he wind up getting from Canada to Venezuela? Literally throwing us in, we did get bits and pieces of his, capture but it certainly was in very different circumstances from these, as he was being, basically wooed and seduced. Recently I've been, I think I mentioned it on one of the roundtables, watching the Mark Cousins Story of Film series, and this whole episode was feeling like some of the South American, like, neorealist films that he was talking about in that series. And it felt like this complete departure, but I actually really enjoyed, I mean, them, you know, throwing him into this extreme situation, and even then by the end of the episode, I mean, winding up with both of them, you know, in these like prison settings, for, you know, with you know, they being, you know, you know, re- you know, with the, but, you know, both wrestling with, you know, with the this drug demon, so which you know, is sort of like, you know, with the, you know, we're talking a little bit in the previous episode of, you know, okay, you know, have, you know, have they gone too far, have they crossed over a line, and, you know, kind of got to the end of this episode and it was like, you know, okay, where you've put these two characters, I don't see where it's going to go from here, but you know, but it was still you know, a rather, you know, it was a, you know, so something, you know, we're not used to seeing from the series, but something I still think they did rather well. But it did just seem to come from completely left field.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that hated this one. I'm not among them at all.
No,
I don't get why. quite frankly, this was completely unexpected. I didn't see it coming, and I like your comment about the South American cinema influence, because I was trying to put my finger on it the entire time, because it did remind me of some unusual independent films, like something you'd see on IFC or Sundance, you know, late at night, and you have no idea who directed this thing, but it had such a very unique visual flair, and that, you know, when you said that, it was like, oh, okay, I can't even name off the top of my head a director that I can think of. Some are on the tip of my tongue, but I can't quite get it there. But it's like, now, okay, I definitely see common cinematography type of aspects to this episode and some films recently that I've seen from that part of the world. And, this felt like a completely different show. This felt like it was almost like a foreign production in that regard. A lot was done visually versus dialogue. It's so much so that when they did get to the plot-driven part of Carrie and this offer from this mysterious law office, it felt intrusive.
Mysterious lawyer,
It just felt out of place with what they were doing with Brody. It almost felt like they should have almost kept Brody's stuff isolated. Like, just have an episode about that, I think, would have been more than enough, but... I was going to say that the parallels between what Brody was enduring and what Carrie was enduring, the two of them psychologically, knowing where the characters have been before, even as much as I disagree with how they got to that point, it was just so emotionally gripping. And the word that came to mind as I was watching it was lyrical. It was just extremely well done. The symbolism that was in there, the unfinished Tower of David, it was just a really completely different type of animal from the first two episodes of the season. And I almost wanted it to become this show that where this was the norm for the rest of the season. Talk about something that would have recaptured the gravitas and just the uniqueness of that first season where there were no expectations of what the show was supposed to be. At the same time, I completely get people that are expecting it to be this cable version of 24 that the show has become, and then see this episode and go, what am I even watching?
So certainly, as I think was clear, I mean, I agree with you on the quality of the episode, but given all my reservations about him coming back, and you know, because I'd really hope that it was like, you know, okay, you know, we can't we're not going to kill him off because, you know, he's been too strong a character, but I really like the idea of, you know, him just being off in exile somewhere, you know, maybe coming back right at the end, so to have him returning that quickly, you know, it, but it, um, You know, but then the idea, you know, that idea you mentioned of, you know, if it had just been on him, and so yeah, you it's just a little check in of, you know, yeah, this is what's happened to Brody, and then just leave him in that situation where you have like no concept of how he could possibly, you know, wind up being part of the show again. which maybe to a certain extent what they're doing anyway, but then tying it with Carrie's situation at the end, and I do just have to mention, because it was one of my favorite shows of all time. I mean, you know, I think a lot of the quality of this was the number of Homicide alumni who were involved. I mean, you had Henry Grimmel, who of course, you know, died tragically and, you know, way too young in the off season. He had started this script. His son finished it. Clark Johnson, who's gone on from being, you know, an actor on Homicide to being this obviously very good director, and also Eric Todd Dellums as that incredibly creepy doctor. I thought it was just a stunning performance, you know, and really helped, you know, create that atmosphere of just, you know, so, you know, surreal, isolation of, you know, yeah, he's just stuck in this place where it's, you know, it's a bunch of misfits and criminals and, a very strange, bad place to be. I too would love to see it continue, even though I'm not hopeful that's going to happen. it was a nice interlude while it lasted.
It felt like Homeland suddenly became a film. I give this a 9. The only reason I didn't give it a 10 was because of, like I said, that it felt intrusive when the plot points for back in DC, or at least the US, kind of snuck in towards the end, and it lost the just stranger in a strange land kind of feel. I know there's probably a better analogy, yeah, but you know,
yeah, we're
Brody, you know, in his dire straits.
Yeah, well, just to throw out another film, yeah, we're the man who fell to earth quality. Of it,
okay, yeah, so. yeah. There you go. That probably actually feels a little bit more fitting to the moment. But how about you? What would you give it?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with the 9. A couple of elements keep it from the, you know, a top score, but a 9 is well deserved.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is that, you know, we're looking at this episode of Homeland and going, wow, this is an exceptional piece of work, and yet it's a departure from what their norm is right now, and it's almost like, we're going to dip back into what they were doing before, aren't we? Instead of going along this completely unexpected and just incredibly awesome other way that they could go. This is the experiment. This is not the norm. It's, oh boy.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, we still have quite a few other shows that we haven't checked in on. I mean, we haven't even talked about Arrow or Person of Interest in a while, but I promise we will get to it, certainly as we are catching back up on things in the next few episodes of our show. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...